All through the Old Testament, we read about people who made a difference, good or bad, I suppose you could say, about the ups and downs of the Israelites, about their sins, about their triumphs. Joshua had crossed the Jordan River, and they had fought some battles. Hadn't finished all that up yet, but I thought I'd double back a little bit into some specific history and talk about three people who made a very large difference in history as we know it today. If you go back here into Genesis chapter 38, I want to look at three women this morning, or this afternoon now, Tamar, Rahab, and Ruth, because they are part of the lineage of Christ. And I think a lot of times in a patriarchal society such as this is, we sort of tend to glance over or not pay attention to the contributions that they made and how they were made. Because after all, these three ladies were unconverted, and the way they went about it has not been agreed by a lot of the scholars that, you know, when you start opening up books and reading people's opinions and whatever, you get opinions all over the map. But I like letting the Bible explain things and sort of give us an idea of what God thought about it. Because, of course, that, you know, in the end, that's really who matters, is what did God think about it and what was the end result of what they did. So let us look at these three ladies and then maybe see if we can apply their lives and the results of their lives to our walk today. So we'll begin in chapter 38. We're sort of jumping in the middle of this giant storyline because Jacob has had two wives with their concubines, four mothers to 12 children. And, you know, if you sort of read between the lines, things weren't real happy. You had a lot of infighting sisters because there's two sets of sisters here. So you have allegations and backbiting and whispers and gossip and favorites and all the thing that goes along in big families. Of course, you now have Joseph, who has been taken and put in a pit, being sold into slavery. You have brothers that have gone off and committed murder in the name of their sister Dinah, and all this stuff going on. And you sort of come to the conclusion that it's just a dysfunctional family, a very large dysfunctional family. Right in the middle of it, we have this story about Judah and Tamar. Genesis 38:1. It came to pass at that time, given all of this background about what's going on in the family, so to speak, Judah departed from his brothers. He just packed up a bag and off he went. And visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. Now, you got to know what's going on here. He has left the anointed ones, if you will, the chosen tribe that God had set aside, starting with Abraham, and he has now gone out into the countryside to live with other people. Okay? These people are not accepted by God. They weren't chosen by God. I mean, if you want to go as far as to say it, as they talk about us today, you're going to the enemy or the infidel, the unconverted, whatever adjective you want to stick on these people. He has now gone into Canaan and started to dwell with the folks who are really going to end up being wiped out a little later on in history. So he's now visiting this gentleman named Hira, and while he was there in this city or this town or whatever, he saw a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. So see, not only has he left the confines of his family and the tribes where you would marry within, he has now gone out into the world, as well, if you want to put a term on it, and he sees this young woman, probably beautiful, named Shua, and he married her. So he's going against God's will. This chosen person, this righteous, supposed righteous man, one of the tribes of the nation of Israel, he has now decided to take a hike and go out here and live his life as he sees fit. And he has now married a woman that he probably shouldn't have married. Continuing, she conceived, bore a son. His name was Ur. She conceived again, bore a son. His name was Onan. She conceived yet a third time, and his name was Shelah. So now you have three kids already in a very short span of time. You know, 3, 4, 5, 6 years, whatever it might be. Bang, bang, bang. three sons. So he was at Chezeb when she bore them. So this now tells us where they're living, in the land of Canaan, which is basically Judea. They're living in the land that they would leave and then come back and be given as the inheritance. So time passes, children start growing up. Judah took a wife, so in other words, he bought a wife, you know, as the society was in that time. He bought a wife, took a wife, if you will, for his firstborn son. Her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of God. Now, he starts to see a pattern here. You know, first Judah does something that he probably shouldn't have done. It wasn't righteous in the sight of God. He goes off and marries another woman, has three children, who are probably not being taught the laws of God, because they already had a certain amount of laws. Maybe they weren't written down, but there were laws, because we've been told that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob were righteous in God's eyes. They did keep the laws as they had been instructed to do for the most part. But here Judah has now separated himself from all that he knew, got out into society and began his own life. And I think we start now seeing the results of that, the fruits of that, because of what's taking place here. So is a wicked person, and God killed him. So as the society was, as things were in this time in history, Judah says to Onan, marry Tamar, I'm paraphrasing obviously, go into her and raise up an heir toward your brother. Well, Onan must not have been any better than his brother, because he wouldn't do it. God killed him. Well, by this time, Judah's probably pretty scared. I've already lost two of my sons. You know, and he's not blaming his sons for being wicked, even though the Bible tells us that he was. You sort of see that you kind of figure it out that he's blaming Tamar. So he says to Tamar, he says, look, go back to your dad's house, wear your widow's clothing, and when my third son grows up to marrying age, I'll give him to you and you can have a family. Now, he had absolutely no intention of doing that. Remember, Judah is the chosen tribe, one of 12, the righteous son who knows the law, and yet he's doing all of these things that we can see are wrong. He's making really bad choices. Tamar, on the other hand, she's doing what she's supposed to do in society, whether you want to call it righteous or not. Let's let God be the judge in how he dealt with this. So, time passes. The third young son grows up. Tamar notices it, but Judah's not fulfilling his promise. Judah's wife dies. So now he's a widow, lonely, nobody meeting his needs. Time for the shearing comes. He goes out to shear the sheep with his workers. Tamar notices this and sets something up that's diabolical in nature, yet in her mind, probably the only thing she could do. Notice, verse 12. Process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. Judah was comforted, went up to the sheep shearers at Timnah. His friend Hira, the Dulamite, was told Tamar, look, your father-in-law is going to Timnah to shear his sheep. So she took off her widow's garments, as we're told here, covered herself in whatever manner of dress would make her look like a harlot. Sat down in a place in the open on the way to Timnah, because she knew that Shelah was grown and he had not been given to her as wife. So when Judah saw her, and remember, Judah now is a widow, probably lonely. You know how you can add to that as you see fit. When he saw her, he thought she was a harlot because she had covered her face. So in that society, the way she dressed meant something. So he goes and says, hey, could I visit you and come into you? Well, her answer to that question, well, what are you going to give me? What are you going to pay me? She's playing the part because she wants an heir. She's trying to fulfill her obligation as a wife to the son of Judah. And in her mind, this is the only thing she can do. What will you give me? I'll send you a young goat from the flock. Okay, that's good, but what are you going to give me as a pledge now so that I'll make sure you pay me. He says, well, what pledge do you want? She said, verse 18, give me your signet and your cord and your staff. Now, when I sign a check or something official, I sign my name and I got my driver's license and that's my ID. An Israelite's ID, or maybe a man of this time, wore a cord of a certain color with a signet, which is like a little stamp, and you would stamp it on a piece, on some wax or some clay, and that's your signature. Same thing with your staff. It's wooden, maybe yay tall, and it's engraved so that people know who you are. That's your sign. Well, him giving her that gave her his identification, just as if I pulled out my credit card and handed it to you and said, have a ball on eBay. That's basically what it means today. She got his identification. Now, it turns out she became pregnant, not only with one, but two children. We're going to see how that plays out as well. So after this little incident, she went back to her life, put her clothing back on. 3 months later, she begins to show. Now, what happens here is very interesting. Judah, in verse 20, sends the young goat, but they couldn't find the woman. He asks around in town. There's nobody sits out there who's a harlot. What do you mean? This is a quiet, honest town. There's nobody sitting out there. So the Adullamite comes back to Judah and says, hey, man, I can't find her. So basically, he has to give up his identity that he'd given her so as not to shame himself. 3 months pass, verse 24. Tamar's showing. Judah finds out about it and goes, up. I got her now. I can get her put away forever, and I don't have to pay my debt. Notice what he says. Bring her out here that she can be burned. See, he's got it set in his mind that she has sinned and he is righteous beyond reproach. I wonder how many times we get in that situation ourselves. And we go down that road because it's the only way you got to tell a lie and then another lie and cover up the second and the third and the fourth. And pretty soon you're out here on a limb and it gets cut out behind you, just like Judah's about to have it cut out behind him. Bring her out so she can be burned. Verse 25, when she was brought out, she sent to her father-in-law and said, by the man to whom these belong, I am with child. Please determine who these are, the signet, the cord, and the staff. So Tamar's father goes out and says, hey, Judah, this is the guy that did it. Who does this belong to? Well, he sees, identifies it as his own. Notice what he says. Judah acknowledged in verse 26, acknowledged them and said, she has been more righteous than I because I did not give her my son. He hadn't fulfilled his part of the bargain. Of course, that was the end of it between him and Tamar. She went off and lived her life. Came to pass that she gave birth. The firstborn stuck his hand out. They put a cord on it, pulled his hand back in. The second son came out and became the firstborn. God, to me, sometimes God's sense of humor just, it makes you stop and think about, wow, you know, a little bit. When she was giving birth, the first one put his hand out. The midwife put the scarlet thread on and bound it on the hand. This one came out first. It happened, verse 29, as he drew back his hand, the brother came out unexpectedly, and she said, how did you break through? This breach be upon you. Therefore, his name was called Perez. Afterward, the brother came out. He was called Zerah. All right, let's kind of hang on to that for a little bit, and let's go to the next one. Turn up to Joshua number 2. Joshua, second chapter. Remember I said there are three individuals I want to talk about. Joshua 2. Now remember, Tamar was a Canaanite, unconverted, and the only amount of God that she could have known was what she might have heard during the time she was living in the family structure of Judah. Remember, she had to go back and live with her father for many years. Think about that as we continue. Chapter 2 of Joshua. Joshua the son of Nun sent out two men. They had to travel 3 days' time to get to the River Jordan, cross the river, and then sneak into Jericho. So we're talking now, that was probably 4 days. They snuck into the city, and there they found a house, and Rahab lived in it. She was a harlot, and she lodged there. Now, it's interesting, if you look into history, what Jericho looked like. We know it was a walled city. But you have an exterior wall that comes up, and you have a platform here where the soldiers would stand along the parapets, and they would fight the battle. Big wall. And then it had walkways to a second interior wall within the city where the lower classes would live within the wall. So the wall was not solid but hollow. And the poorer people of the town would live within that second wall. And that's where these two spies managed to get. In other words, they didn't go all the way into the city, into the middle of town. They just snuck in, kind of got to the edge and kind of maybe looked around. And there they found this lower class woman who probably was living hand to mouth. For whatever reason, they came to her house and she put them up. You know, and we don't really have a lot of the details that explains how or why all this happened. But the king found out about it and said, "Behold, men have come here tonight from the children of Israel to search the country out." Verse 3, the king sent to Rahab. Now, why would he send to her? Probably because she was right inside that second gate to see where the travel, where all the people would walk in and out. Good place for a harlot to live, because the traffic would be such that she could probably get customers very easily. You start putting all these pieces together and you understand why God probably sent those two men to that lady. But let's notice something about this woman. The king says to Rahab, "Bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search our country out." They're scared. They understand what's about to happen to some degree. Verse 4. Woman took the men and hid them. She put them up on her roof underneath a pile of plants here so that they weren't seen. She then tells the king, notice in verse 4, he said, "Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from, and it happened as the gate was being shut. When it was dark, they snuck out." She told a bald-faced lie here. And a lot of scholars say, she's a sinner. She can't be in, you know, God can't have mercy on her, blah, blah, blah. And yet, let's see what happens here. Let's notice the character of Rahab, because I think it plays a big part in why God blessed her. So she continues this facade. I don't know where they went after they left, but you need to pursue them, she says, quickly, for you may overtake them. But notice verse 6, she had brought them up on the roof and hidden them with stalks of flax, which she had laid in order on the roof. She had stuck them together in such a way that it made a covering so the men could breathe and not be killed because of the weight of it, and yet they could probably see between the stalks and hear and understand that she was protecting them. The men pursued by the road to the Jordan, to the ford. So they went to the east and they went all the way to the Jordan River following these guys, supposedly. But as soon as they went out to pursue them, they shut the gate. Before she laid down, in verse 8, she came to them on the roof and said to them, now notice what she says, because this is really important. "I know that the Lord has given you this land." How is she going to know that unless God had actually told her? In some way, she had a feeling or a thought or something in her mind to convict her that God was God. "I know that the Lord has given you this land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that the inhabitants of this land are faint-hearted because of you." Their courage is completely melted away. The same way in which the courage of the fighters that went to Ai, the Israelites, their courage melted away and they lost that battle. Notice verse 10. "We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. As soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted." Now, this is a very short synopsis of what must have been a really long conversation. The gist of which is, these people were absolutely terrified of what was coming. This mighty army of the Israelites, this fierce, overpowering army of the Israelites. "Neither was there any courage in anyone because of you, for the Lord your God, notice what she says, the Lord your God, He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Did Judas say that? At any time in the story we just read? Who's the righteous person here? Tamar was more righteous than Judah. She is more righteous than a lot of the Israelites who were out there in that army marching around that city. She has a faith and a belief in God that not even most of the Israelites had. How many had already been destroyed because of their sins? And yet here, she is convicted within her heart and her mind that God is God in heaven and earth. Very interesting, if you ask me. So now she begs for help. Swear by me, by your Lord, since I have shown you kindness, that you will also show me kindness to my family. And we know the rest of the story, how she hid them. They lived up to their end of the bargain. When the walls of Jericho fell, the same two spies that had been on her roof went back in and saved her entire family. And she went and lived with the Israelites and married an Israelite from the tribe of Judah. And we'll see what ends up happening here in just a minute. That's 2 out of 3. Last place I want to look real quick is Ruth. The book of Ruth is very short. It's very poignant. And again, it is punctuated with character, good and bad, that becomes part of the thread of the Bible. Ruth was Naomi's daughter-in-law, married to one of her sons. And during a point in time of great trial in Israel, they moved across to the east beyond the Dead Sea to Moab. Now the area of Moab is Lot and his daughter's progeny. That's who inhabited Moab. So Moabites were looked down upon because of the sin of Lot and his two daughters. So you can imagine what that must have been like if you were a Moabitess coming back into the land of Israel, having married an Israelite. That's the framework that we find ourselves in here. But after Naomi's husband died and her two sons died, Ruth bonded with Naomi and came back into the land and left her family, her religion, and all of the structure that she knew in Moab, forsook it all, and came back to live with her mother-in-law in Judea. Now we know that in chapter 2, she meets Boaz. She's going out into the field to glean because she was a poor person. She had to go out and glean. Boaz meets her, has compassion upon her, says not only can you glean, but he instructs his workers to leave extra for her. Because although she is a Moabitess, she's Naomi's daughter-in-law. And Naomi is Boaz's aunt. So there is close kin here. Boaz is giving her this extra because he is honoring this family position. So not only do we have a righteous woman who has forsaken everything she knew, but now we have a man here who is rich in his own right and giving her, out of his compassion, giving her these extras. So we understand how the story goes, that at the end of the harvest, when the threshing is taking place, the men all come in, there's a lot of food and wine, the men lay down, and the ladies who are single can then come up and tuck themselves in at the feet of the man they want to marry. Ruth here takes a very, very bold step. Notice an unconverted woman who for whatever reason forsook her land and came back and lived as a Moabitess, being spit upon, looked down upon by all the other people except for Boaz. So she boldly tucks herself under Boaz's cover. He discovers her, honors it, and says, I will take care of you. You can see God's hand in all of this. She could have been stoned, for all we know, by the other members of the family tribes in the area, but yet God has given her protection, given her a man who is now going to take compassion on her. Naomi can't be any happier for it, but there's a wrench in this whole thing. Notice over here in chapter 4, Boaz isn't the closest of kin to Naomi. There's another man in the way. So Boaz has to set up a situation where he can redeem Naomi and Ruth instead of this other man. Notice chapter 4. Boaz went up to the gate and sat down. Behold, the close relative of Boaz had come by, and Boaz spoke to him. Here, sit down. So he came and sat down, and the men and the elders, all gathered as they were apt to do all the time, sit down here, they sat down. And then he starts talking about his close relative, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, sold a piece of land, because Naomi had absolutely nothing but this land. She's had to sell it to get money to live on. Sold a piece of land which belonged to Elimelech, her husband. And I thought to inform you, by the way, to buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants of the elders. If you will redeem it, if you won't, then tell me that I may know, because I will redeem it. Well, the guy says, I'll redeem it. He hasn't thought this thing through. So Boaz, on the day that they were supposed to buy the land from Naomi, says, you must buy it also from Ruth, because she was married to the son, the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to perpetuate the name of the dead through the inheritance. In other words, this second guy had to marry Ruth and have a son by her in the dead husband's name. Just like and Onan before, notice what happened. Verse 6, the close relative says, hey, wait a minute. You didn't tell me that before. I can't do that. I can't redeem it for myself. Notice, lest I ruin my own inheritance. He's scared that he might lose what he had from his parents, that his parents would look down upon him and, no, we're going to disinherit you. He says, you redeem my right of redemption for yourself, for I'm not going to do it. Who's righteous here and who's not? This was the custom in former times in Israel concerning the redeeming and exchanging. To confirm anything, one man then took off his sandal and gave it to the other. So the deal was struck, and Boaz was allowed to marry Ruth instead of the one who should. Now let's go over here to Matthew chapter 1, because this becomes very important, these three ladies. Matthew chapter 1, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Let's read through here and see what takes place and how these three ladies in their time frame of their life and the history of Israel played out. Abraham begat Isaac. Isaac begat Jacob. Jacob begat Judah and his brothers. The reason why Judah is listed here is because Jesus came from Judah's lineage. Judah begat Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Now notice in this lineage that there are only, four really, women listed, Mary being one of them. This is a patriarchal book written in a patriarchal way, and women by and large are not mentioned in a genealogy. But this is important to God, to Jesus, the God of the Old Testament, the Son of God, and to us for several reasons. Judah beget Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Perez beget Hezron. Hezron beget Ram. Notice no women listed. Ram beget Amminadab. Amminadab beget Nashon. Nashon beget Salmon. Salmon beget Boaz by Rahab, second woman. Boaz beget Obed by Ruth. Notice how the lineage is flowing and that these three ladies play this integral part. Obed beget Jesse. Jesse beget David. David beget Solomon, as we know. On down 15 more generations, Mary beget Jesus. It's interesting that God decided to do this way. It really is to me. God, our Father, is a sovereign God. It's His book. It's His plan. It's His rules. His game, if you will. Out of His character and His kindness, His grace, His mercy, His sense of humor, call it what you will, He blessed the actions of these three women regardless of how they went about doing what they did. Rahab lied. Lied. We're told we're not supposed to lie. God covered it up and blessed her. For whatever reason He chose to, she is in the lineage. Tamar, same thing. She dressed up as a hooker and stood on the street corner and lured Judah in. But in her mind, that was the only way for her to have a son in within the tribe of Judah, to which she was rightly obligated. And Ruth could have went back home to her mom and dad in Moab and lived a life and probably married and had a whole bunch of kids, yet she forsook all of what she knew, as unconverted as she was, and came back and lived with Naomi and lived in poverty until Boaz made it right. Each of these fulfilled their destiny because God allowed them to, and God blessed them despite of their sins. And a lot of times I think we get put in the same boat every day of our lives. Decisions that we make may sometimes be just as wrong can be. Like moving out of a really nice house into an itty-bitty little apartment that burns down 3 weeks later. I don't know. I don't know why all that happened to Helen and I. It did. And we're being blessed on the other end of it because our house is now sold, the one that we moved out of because we couldn't afford. Now we're having another house built fairly close to where the old one was. The insurance has paid off what it's supposed to pay off, and we've got a little bit of money to deal with making the payments and everything that we have to do on the new place. It has all worked out, not because of anything we did. I made the wrong decisions in moving out in the first place. If I'd have had enough faith, we'd have probably stayed where we were and made it work. You know, that should have probably been the right thing. Well, Tamar may not have needed to do what she did, but she did it. Rahab might not have needed to lie had she had the Holy Spirit. Maybe God would have slipped her some thought or something that she would have done the right thing. Ruth was probably the most righteous of the bunch, and she was blessed in doing what she did, obviously. But every one of them in their converted state made their decisions. Let's notice a couple of verses here. Let's go to Ephesians 2. Because I think this plays in our lives. And, you know, it shows God's humor. It shows God's will being worked out. It shows God's mercy covering the sins of the folks that made these actions. But let's notice Ephesians 2 and go back to verse 11. It says, therefore, remember that you, once Gentiles in the flesh, once, if you want to call it, unbelievers, unconverted, if you will, who are of the uncircumcision, but by what was called the circumcision. So he's now talking ethnically here, by flesh, that at the time you were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel. Now, weren't these three ladies aliens from the commonwealth of Israel? Yet they chose Israel over whatever else they could have had. God chose them to perform a function. Maybe they didn't do it the best way they could. And a lot of the times I think we are in the same boat. God has chosen every one of us here. He hasn't made us perfect yet. We still stumble in life, just like these three ladies did. Yet they were blessed because of their actions. And our blessing, as we understand it, is a spirit being, body, eternity, and government authority and responsibilities in Christ's kingdom. But we used to be aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise, just like they, having no hope and without God in the world. They were without God in the world. So were we. We're not any different than they were. But now in Christ Jesus, who was the God of the Old Testament, whom they dealt with and talked to, you who were once afar off have been brought near by the blood of Jesus Christ. So we have been so fortunate to have been brought in by the blood. They dealt with whatever they dealt with in their own mind and came to Christ in their own way. We are so fortunate to have Christ's blood covering our sins. Christ blessed them in the Old Testament like He has blessed us now. Also, let's notice, go up a couple of chapters to chapter 4. Notice that verse 7, but to each one of us, grace was given according to the measure of Christ's gift. Grace was given to them as well. Therefore, he says, when he ascended on high, he led captivity captive and gave gifts to men. Jesus gave gifts to them of his mercy as well. We have been so blessed to understand what we understand. They probably had a little niche in time where God talked to them and led them in their actions, even though they might have fumbled around in their life. And also notice 1 Peter 4:18. Go back to verse 17. For the time has come for judgment to begin at the house of God, and if it begins with us, what will be the end of those who do not obey the gospel of God? Now, if the righteous one is scarcely saved, where will the ungodly and the sinner appear? Therefore, let those who suffer according to the will of God commit their souls to Him in doing good as to a faithful Creator. We have done that, and Peter here quotes Proverbs 10:12. We have done this very same thing. We have committed ourselves just like they did, and eventually I think we're going to be blessed for it. What's the ending moral of the story then? Well, I think we can finish up in Romans 8, verse 14. We're told in Passover to always examine ourselves to see if we're in the faith. And I thought about that this week. It doesn't say to examine ourselves to see that we're perfect. It doesn't examine ourselves to see that we're righteous. It doesn't examine ourselves to see that we're better than anybody else. It says to examine ourselves to see that we're in the faith. What does that mean? It means we believe in something we can't see, feel, or touch. And yet we live our lives in a way striving for perfection. Well, in much the same way, these three ladies did exactly the same thing. But notice the end result. Let's start in verse 12, chapter 8, book of Romans. Therefore, brethren, we are debtors, not to the flesh, not to live according to the flesh. We're debtors to live to Christ because He stepped in and showed us a better way. He died for us. If we live according to the flesh, we will die. If we live by the Spirit, we put to death the deeds of the flesh. Now, these three ladies had no idea what the Spirit was, yet they tried the best way they knew how, given the information that they had, to change their lives for the better. But notice, if for as many, verse 14, as are led by the Spirit of God, weren't these three led by the Spirit of God? Some way, somehow, God led them to do what they did and blessed them as a result. For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, these are sons and daughters of God. And when you look, they're in the lineage of Christ. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. When they are resurrected and they're spirit beings, we're going to honor them for being in that lineage. Thing is, though, you extend this verse out and you come past us, we're in the lineage too. We are brothers and sisters of Jesus Christ. For you did not receive the spirit of bondage, but you received the spirit of adoption. They were adopted into the family of God and became part of the very structure of Jesus' DNA when He was born in a physical body. We are part of the very structure spiritually in Jesus' DNA that has been put right here. I mean, it flows so seamlessly. We have been adopted, and we can cry, Abba, Father, Daddy, I need you. I've made a mistake. Please help. Please guide me. The Spirit itself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. I wonder how these three ladies felt living their life, bearing their children, never knowing what it produced generations down the line. We can sit here and read the words and look back and kind of postulate on how they would feel, you know, if we were in their shoes and know what we know now. But just knowing that the Spirit bears witness with ours that we are children of God, I can exalt in God because I know that I'm part of this genealogy. It's nothing I did. I'm part of the genealogy. So how should that make us feel and how should that make us live our lives? Well, we know we have a big job to do. We know we're children of God. And despite the fact that we're going to fumble around and make mistakes, if we trust in God and have faith in God's plan, it's outlined right here, we know we're going to be blessed in the end. Body.